Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
Welcome back to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show. This is part B of segment of podcast 837, coming to you live from the Cleveland Clinic and wherever Dr. Robert Greenberg is. He is our guest for this segment. He has written the protocols on which the bionic eye is now being tried, especially for retinitis pigmentosa patients. We'll get to that in a second. Anytime you have a guest you want us to have or suggestions for guests, just email me, ageprooflife@gmail.com, ageprooflife@gmail.com. And we'll try and accommodate you. Questions for our guests. We always post the guests in advance on our Twitter feed at Dr. Mike Roizen and at Your Do-Over. If you want that, to ask a question for any of the guests or follow us, you can follow us easily that way or on LinkedIn or Facebook. So we have Dr. Robert Greenberg, who is both an MD, PhD, and an ophthalmologist who has done really what I would call breakthrough work, and we're going to find out about that in just a second, but a little bit about Dr. Greenberg. How did you get into this field, Dr. Greenberg, and welcome to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show and Podcast.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to be here. This actually started originally, more than 25 years ago now, as a graduate research project at Johns Hopkins, where I was doing my MD, PhD. And I and a couple other surgeons had a concept that perhaps we could restore vision to blind patients in much the same way that cochlear implants were restoring hearing to deaf individuals. And so that was really the inspiration for this. And so at Hopkins, we were doing the early research to see if it was possible.
And I should say that Hopkins is one of what we always consider one of the three most prominent, best clinical care eye institutes in the world. And Cleveland Clinic is also rated as one of those. And you have a group of these. USC, Kellogg Eye Center at Ann Arbor, Duke, Emory, UIC in Chicago, Retinal Consultants of Hawaii, Bascom Partners in Miami, Will's Eye in Philadelphia, Johns Hopkins, as we said, University of Minnesota, Mayo Clinic, Toronto Western, University of Colorado, University of Montreal, and the Cleveland Clinic, all of which you're doing these clinical trials. And this is really groundbreaking research with what is called a bionic eye. So let's explain, why did you pick first retinitis pigmentosa, and then how does the bionic eye work with that to help restore sight, or what we hope helps restore sight?
Sure. I think one of the things that I'd like to clarify is that we're actually beyond the clinical trial stage, and these products are now FDA approved and reimbursed by Medicare and a number of other insurance companies. So this is actually a proven technology, although it's not as widely known as we'd like yet.
Which just shows you that I didn't even know it was already in clinical practice, and I knew it was approved by the FDA. I just didn't know it was already widely distributed. I apologize because you even caught me on that.
No worries. And you know, it is something because it has such a science fiction element to it that it really is the first time that we've been able to restore some vision to the blind. And so I think because of that, I think people tend to assume that it is still in clinical trials. But actually, we started our clinical trials back in 2002. And we have patients today that have had these devices implanted for over 10 years. And the concept and the way it works is, as I mentioned, similar to cochlear implants. So the way cochlear implants work is they'll actually, there's an external device like a hearing aid that picks up sound from the person's environment. And then that sound is wirelessly transmitted to an implant in the ear. So we've kind of take the taken the analogous idea for vision, and we have a pair of glasses that has a small video camera in it, just like the video camera on your cell phone. And then we take the signal from that video camera, and we wirelessly transmit it to an implant in the patient's eye. The implants are put in an outpatient procedure. Patients go home the same day. Once the person gets the implant, you can't see the implant. The patients can't feel the implant. It really becomes part of their eye. And the implant has what's called an array of electrodes, a number, 60 electrodes, in a two-dimensional grid, basically. And the image from the camera is mapped to that grid. And so by putting a little bit of electrical activity, a little bit of electrical stimulation through each one of those electrodes in the grid, the patient sees spots of light. And the brain is able to interpret those spots of light as images, moving images, just like looking at lights on a scoreboard or pixels on a monitor. So today
person is seeing either a dark or light area in 60 spots on their on the back of their eye, essentially. Is that correct?
That's right. So it's levels of gray at this point. So it's kind of like a blurry black and white television at this point. We are experimenting in the clinic with color vision and finer resolution. But today I would describe it as a blurry black and white TV.
And now it's used for retinitis pigmentosa. How did you happen to pick that as the first disease or condition that you went after?
Yeah, it's a great question. So RP is a relatively rare disease. It's a genetic disease, so it tends to run in families. And the reason we chose RP as kind of the prototype, an initial target, was twofold. One is these patients, unfortunately, the way this disease presents itself is patients in their 20s typically will start having difficulty seeing at night, and they'll go to their ophthalmologist and, you know, expecting to need glasses, and instead they're told that they're going to go blind. And the way they're going to go blind is that their entire world is going to close in on them gradually from the periphery, and until they're left with a small little pinhole of vision, and then they'll lose that as well. So because these patients go completely blind, and we had done some studies at Hopkins, some early studies, looking at the histology, looking under the microscope at patients who had passed away for other reasons who had retinitis pigmentosa, we knew that the optic nerve or the cable going back to the brain from the eye was still working in these patients, but they were otherwise completely blind. So we knew there were some cells in the retina, which is the nerves in the back of the eye, that were still alive. And we thought if we could stimulate those nerves, we might be able to restore vision in these patients. So it was in a lot of ways, the perfect place to start. We can talk more about the research that we're doing now in bypassing the optic nerve and going directly to the brain with a device we call the Orion that'll begin clinical trials this year. And that one obviously is not approved. It's just starting human clinical work. But that has the potential to treat all forms of blindness, not just retinitis pigmentosa.
So the value of retinitis pigmentosa was you, one, proved that you could help people with their quality of life, help them avoid accidents, as I understand it, help them function better from a visual standpoint in general. But it's, if you will, fuzzy, as you say, and black and white.
But that's right. I think it was twofold. It was proof of principle. Proof that we could make a difference in these patients' lives. And it was really, like you said, a first step and life-changing for somebody who had no vision to get fuzzy vision back.
Now, part of this is really just the first step in helping us gain not only vision back, but all of our senses back. Is there any reason you couldn't do this with taste in a like fashion?
Yeah, I think, hearing is being done commercially, vision is being done commercially. There has been some experimentation on touch. I'm not aware of anybody doing it for taste, although it should work the same way.
And smell as well, I suppose.
And smell as well. Yeah, and I'm not aware of anybody doing it for smell, but for sure people are working on touch for use with prosthetics. So if you had a prosthetic arm, you could imagine you'd not only want to be able to control the arm by just thinking about it, but you'd also like to get feedback, touch feedback from the arm as well. And so there are groups working on that.
So the company that you're chair of is called, I think, Second Sight, and the website would be secondsight.com for anyone interested in this. Retinitis pigmentosa work is going on. Let's talk a little bit about Orion One. So Orion One is the next step, and tell me, is there, I mean, we're making this sound pretty simple, but it's one, you've got to implant a device. Two, it's got to be miniature. Three, you've got to have something miniature in the eye. Four, it's got to be conducted from that, if you will, video camera in the eye back to the device in the back of the eye. And from the back of the eye, has to have connected an implant and have some sequence with the brain. And then I suppose another problem is you got to make sure there's no outside interference so someone doesn't get weird signals in their for their sight in their brain. Now you're going even another, what I would call logarithm, or a very great big step in difficulty by implanting something right in the brain. Is that right with Orion One?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And the problems that you describe were absolutely some of the significant problems we had to solve. In addition to in creating the Argus II retinal prosthesis, and in fact, we spent probably the better part of 15 years and a couple hundred million dollars solving those issues. The other challenge, significant challenge we had, is the body is a saltwater environment, so it's like taking your, and we're taking electronics and having them survive it. So like take your TV, throw it in the ocean, and oh yeah, by the way, we want to shrink it to the size of an aspirin so it'll fit in an eye. So all of that technology development that we had to do for the Argus II, we've been able to leverage for the Orion. So we've actually, in a very short time, in just the last couple of years, modified the Argus II so that it could be placed in the brain, and we've actually completed animal studies and are just now completing the software, and in the coming months we'll be applying to the FDA to begin human clinical work with a direct brain
this
implant.
Is on, so for people who've lost their sight for other reasons, meaning macular degeneration or something else where that cable has deteriorated from the front of the eye to the what we call the optic cortex, where we see in the brain, that this replaces that, and this is a device where the little pill is put right on the brain. Is that right?
Yeah. So the pill. So there's kind of two parts to the implant. There's a pill and a flexible plastic what we call electrode array or grid that I was describing earlier, and so the pill actually sits just underneath the skin in the head, and then the plastic piece is a very, very tiny hole in the skull, and this tiny plastic piece sits on the surface of the brain. So it actually doesn't even go into the brain at all, but is able to just sit on the surface. So it's really more skull surgery than brain surgery. But
wow, when you think of it, when I obviously know enough on medicine to be dangerous, and when you think of this, the bionic nature of it, I guess the ability to do something with the brain is really impressive. Has this been tried at all in humans to know that they can see color, or how good is the vision with this compared to the, if you will, the initial device?
The Argus II. Yeah, it's a great question. I think, you know, I think there are a couple aspects to it. I think there probably won't be much patient overlap. So if you could get an Argus II, if you were eligible for an Argus II, and actually, we are conducting trials in macular degeneration in England, using the Argus II in Manchester. We implanted 5 patients who had macular degeneration. And as far as which will be better, it's a little hard to know. One of the things we did do, though, is towards the end of last year in 2016, we did implant at UCLA a single patient using a commercially available neurostimulator. So this was a device that was designed for treating patients with epilepsy and only had 8 electrodes and obviously didn't have a camera, but we were able to hook this 8 electrode implant up to a computer to stimulate the electrodes one at a time. Basically, to answer the question that you just asked, was will the person see the spots of light with this brain stimulator, and could they see colors? And the short answer is yes to both of those. We were able to produce like we expected, the spots of light using this relatively crude stimulator. And so we're really looking forward to, so it really validated the basic approach, and we're really looking forward to later this year implanting a full-up system with a camera and glasses similar to the Argus II that the patients could actually take home and use.
Now, my producer has asked me to ask you the question about interference with other electronic devices. We live in a world which has to have tons and tons of electromagnetic devices. Do you get a special wavelength from the FDA, or how does that work for medical devices in general and for this in specific?
Yeah, no, great question. And actually, years ago, I was actually a medical officer at the FDA, and so I had been on the other side of this, asking other people those same questions. So we were prepared for that question, and in fact, there were two aspects that we needed to meet. One was actually the FCC, because the device has a transmitter on it. It's also regulated by the FCC. But as far as the FDA was concerned, they had exactly that question, and we literally needed to test hundreds of different radio transmitters and to make sure that they would not interfere with the device, and that if they did interfere, that it would not result in any unsafe electrical stimulation to the patient. So we tested probably a dozen different brands of cell phones, old cell phones, new cell phones, microwave ovens, the electronic devices that when you go at a store through the doorway, the security systems that detect the theft of the devices. I'm trying to think of some of the other devices that we tested, but there was a myriad of maybe 100 different types of devices to test for interference with the product. And unfortunately, we were able to pass those tests.
This is a tour de force. We're talking with Dr. Robert Greenberg. He's an MD, PhD, chair of the board, and founder of Second Sight Medical Products. Second Sight is the provider of the bionic eye, if you will, something that works with retinitis pigmentosa, as we said in the first segment, to help people live with more sight, live safer, be able to see shadows, be able to navigate, and have a higher quality of life. What they're developing now at Second Sight is this device called, I guess it's called the Argus 2, Orion 1. It's being done at a number of places, USC, Kellogg, Duke, Emory, UIC in Chicago, Retinitis Consultants of Honolulu, Bascom Palmer in Miami, Will's Eye in Philadelphia, Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, University of Minnesota, Mayo Clinic, Toronto Western, University of Colorado, University of Montreal, and our own Cleveland Clinic. And just to tell you about next week's guest, it will be Andy Weil, who has a great book, just a sensational book, on how you get off of medication and onto lifestyle changes and integrative approaches for healing. Let's go back to Robert Greenberg. If you want to, this has been a 20-year adventure and I suppose a huge challenge, Dr. Greenberg. But if you were to say, how fast do you expect? We seem to be accelerating a lot of things in what would be called this electronic and artificial intelligence world to get to how the brain works. How fast would you expect? These are difficult experiments and difficult approval processes, but how long do you think it's going to take to be able to understand whether this will work or not work for macular degeneration? And then there probably are, 6 million people in the world who are have this adult onset of blindness. It should work for all of this group, or what part of this group?
A great question. Two great questions. I'll start with macular degeneration. So with this initial group of five patients, of course, the goal was to answer that question: could this device work in these patients? And macular degeneration are a little bit different than retinitis pigmentosa patients. One of the reasons we started with RP and not AMD is the RP patients, as we described earlier, go completely blind. The AMD patients or macular degeneration patients tend to have some peripheral vision, so they can see out the sides of their eye a little bit. And because they're not completely blind, they're not quite as disabled, although they're still significantly impacted by losing their central vision. You can imagine everywhere you look being black. And what we're doing so far with these, what we've shown that we can do so far with these patients, is we can fill in that black area. And so the patients are able to see something in the black region, and they're able to actually use it in conjunction with their peripheral vision. So those were some of the really big questions that we had before implanting the first patient. And so we know that answer now. And really, the next challenge that we have is can we demonstrate that the central vision that we're restoring is actually better than their peripheral vision? Or are there some benefits other than the patients seem to like it, the doctor likes it? Can we demonstrate an objective reason for governments to pay for these therapies with the macular degeneration patients? So that's where we're at with those patients. How long will it take us to do that is a little hard to say. In the coming years, we'll implant, we'll continue to improve the software. One of the things we didn't talk about is the Argus 2, which is a commercially available retinal product, is software upgradable. So just like your iPhone, you can download new software and hopefully improve the quality of the vision. And I mentioned that we're experimenting in the clinic with color vision as another possibility for a future software upgrade. So as those software upgrades come along and as we're able to improve the quality of the vision, I would expect it to become more meaningful for macular degeneration patients. And so that's our current strategy with respect to AMD. With respect to the Orion, the direct brain stimulator for the 6 million blind patients that you mentioned, we've tested the basic concept in one patient. The basic concept seems to work. We'll test another 5 to 10 patients starting later this year with the actual Orion device, with the actual glasses and system. And I think based on that testing, we'll know how quickly we'll be able to go to a commercially available product. If that testing goes as well as we would expect, we would very quickly move to what's known as a pivotal study, so enroll more patients. And work towards getting approval. So I think it's the kind of thing that in the next 2-3 years, perhaps, we could have a commercially available product for all blindness.
Well, we've been talking with Dr. Robert Greenberg, and as they say in everything, Godspeed, because this is really, you are doing some of God's work in helping us restore sight. The company is Second Sight. You can go on their website, secondsight.com, and find out more about their clinical trials, where they are, how to enroll, as well as about the company. Dr. Robert Greenberg, thank you very much. Thank you for helping all of us who worry about our sight. And thank you for being on You, the Owner's Manual radio show. This is podcast 837, segment B. The guest is Dr. Robert Greenberg. We will be back next week. Again, every Tuesday we have a new podcast. Next week's guest, Dr. Andy Weil, Mind Over Meds, a wonderful book. We'll be right back.